Hello, and welcome to the Total Football Soccer Show, Richmond's first, only, and therefore best football talk show. I'm Taylor, and I am home alone this week as Daryl is off visiting Delaware. No one is entirely sure why, but not to worry, because we still have plenty to talk about. We'll discuss football in Iran, where four national team players were forcibly retired for wearing green armbands during a World Cup qualifier, and you thought the FCC had strong clothing restrictions. Plus, the Richmond Kickers bested the Charlotte Eagles to claim the USL 2 championship. We caught up with some of the more jubilant players to get their thoughts on the game. And not wanting to leave you all jonesing for his accent, Daryl took time away from his busy pre-holiday schedule to record a top five. This week, it's our all-time favorite players. As previously mentioned, this summer, the Iranian national team took on South Korea in a World Cup qualifier. Several Iranian players elected to wear green armbands as a long-distance show of support for their compatriots back home who were protesting the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Well, the Iranian government didn't take too kindly to that, and now the players are seeing the ramifications of that action. Since early June, Amin Vafa has been closely following the election. He got on the phone with us to discuss the situation and its more recent developments. All right, Amin, well, thanks for taking the phone call today.
No problem.
So I guess to get started, why don't you give us a little background as to your involvement in this whole story?
I have an Iranian-American background, and I've been following some of the fallout from the past presidential election pretty much since it happened. I noticed there was like a communication lockdown pretty soon after all the election results were disputed, and I wanted to kind of get the message out that the Iranian people were, you know, different than their government. I've had some family and friends that were in Iran, you know, during this time, and we were getting as much information as we could from them, but we had problems with, you know, obviously, like, Facebook was shut down. They had trouble getting messages out through Twitter, and phone conversations were being tapped and things like that. So there was a huge, like, communication lockdown.
How do they know? Is there, like, just a certain way to know that the phone's being tapped? Do you hear, like, clicks? Is there someone, you know, breathing on the other end?
Sometimes it's a lot like that. And there's actually not as many online, so it's easy to, like, kind of have a bottleneck. So if we want calls to get through, there are, like, operators, I guess, that are standing by.
Oh, okay.
And sometimes you hear, like, you know, voices or whatever on the other line, and they're, like, listening for certain keywords and things like that. So you have to be very careful in the type of words you say.
Can you give us a little, you know, as best you can, summary of what happened with the presidential election and who was actually running?
It was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He just finished his first term. He was up for re-election. He had kind of a bad reputation internationally, and no one in Iran really liked him either.
Wait, is that it? Really? No one in Iran really likes him?
Well, the majority of the people in Iran don't really like him. There's, like, the religious, you know, staunch religious base that really liked him, and the religious hierarchy that liked him. But, you know, for the most part, you know, normal, middle-of-the-road people didn't like him.
Okay.
And he was kind of, like, you know, very standoffish, not a good centrist president. So there were three other candidates that were running in the election. And the most prominent one was Mir Hossein Mousavi, and he actually was involved in Iranian politics earlier. He was actually the first prime minister of Iran. So basically, Mousavi was gaining a lot of exposure in the weeks approaching the election. A lot of people thought that he was actually gonna win. There were reports that there were, you know, long lines taking hours to get into the voting booths, and there was huge voter turnout. And then when the results came, they basically showed that Ahmadinejad won in almost a landslide.
Yeah, it was like 63%, I think it said.
Yeah, so it was like over 60%, basically.
Yeah.
Knocked everybody.
From there, I guess, like, that's pretty much, I guess, where it got, like, the majority of the coverage in the United States was the aftermath of the election, because I guess you saw the people in the streets, and then you saw the reaction to the people in the streets.
Right. There was definitely a backlash. It wasn't as strong at the beginning, but they started, you know, increasing the strength of the backlash. There's, like, Iranian paramilitary militia forces called Basij, and they are pro-government, but they're not technically tied to the government, so the government can, like, kind of sever ties with them if they do something crazy. But they were the ones doing a lot of the groundwork of, like, attacking people. So, like, people were coming out for peaceful protests, and they were being, you know, shot or beaten up and things like that. And that was, like, the image that was being portrayed.
Forgive me, because I'm not going to be able to pronounce these as well as you can, but is it Mousavi?
Yeah.
Okay. And then he chose, as his kind of campaign theme or his symbol or whatever, he chose the color green.
Right.
Does that have, like, a special significance?
There's a little bit green. It's, like, on the Iranian flag, too, and it's also a symbol of, it's, like, one of the colors of Islam. And Mousavi, he's the first prime minister of Iran after the Islamic Revolution, and he was actually pretty religious, and he was a follower of Khomeini. Not necessarily sure if, you know, this was a rallying cry behind that, but it was definitely a unifying, like, brotherhood.
You're listening to the Total Football Soccer Show with Daryl
and Taylor
on Richmond Independent Radio 97.3, radio for the rest of us.
So against that backdrop, the Iranian national team has a World Cup qualifier in South Korea against South Korea. I believe six of their players decided to show their support, their solidarity with people back home.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wear the green armbands. I guess it's pretty much just linking to Mousavi in the green.
Right. It was linking to that. And I think a big part of that was, from what I read, the team had been, because of the qualifiers, had been traveling a lot, and so they weren't in Iran at the time of the election.
Mm-hmm.
But they could see the coverage in media, and, you know, they wanted to show support for the family and people, and they put on these, you know, a handful of them put on these green wristbands, and, you know, to show their small support in, like, a public sphere. I've heard as many as eight of them put on the wristbands. I read over and over that six of them had, but I've only seen a picture of definitively five of them.
Yeah. So, see, I think that might be sort of what you're talking about, though, and sort of what you're talking about with, like, the state control of everything, is that basically, you know, these guys wore the armbands. They're told to take them off. I believe all but one did. And then after the match, yeah, you know, obviously there's negative ramifications, but the main part of that is that they're not allowed to talk to, well, besides the fact that they're forcefully retired, they're not allowed to talk to any media outlet at all. So no one really knows if they actually retired or if they were forcefully retired, but I guess it's safe to assume that the government probably had some role in this.
Right. The majority of people who believe that the election was corrupt believe that they were forcibly retired. And there's, like, different conflicting stories. Three of the people who were retired were over the age of 30, but one of them was 24.
Okay.
And
a lot of people are retiring at the age of 24 nowadays.
Right. You know, I've been thinking about it myself. As, you know, I need to take my feet and relax. Less taxing, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, these guys retired. They said, you know, they were forcibly retired. There's no straight story, but it looks increasingly like they were pushed out. Another thing that happened was the coach of the team, Afshin Qutbi, he was actually, you know, he's an American citizen, but he's, like, an Iranian-American, and he coached in a couple different countries. And he's had a couple of interviews since, and I want to say, you know, no, these were, the players told me that the wristbands were religious significance, and, you know, they retired on their own. And, you know, I think, I don't know if he's, you know, wants to be on the side of the regime, but, you know, it's kind of a cushy job, and I don't think he really wants to do anything to push his luck with it. And his contract recently got renewed.
Yeah, I think at that point it's important to point out Iran has actually gotten in trouble before. In international soccer, it's FIFA goes out of their way to, FIFA is the international governing body of world football, they go out of their way to separate politics from sport. For example, in the 06 World Cup, the United States actually tried to petition to have Iran not included because they were pursuing, you know, nuclear technologies, and they were blocked completely because that's a political objective. But Iran's gotten in trouble for this before, because Ahmadinejad, after Iran lost to Saudi Arabia in another World Cup qualifier, he had basically had the coach fired and installed the coach that you're talking about now. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that this coach is, you know, kind of towing the party line.
Right. I mean, he was actually president. He was present. At the inauguration, he had a lot of public support, and a lot of people saw that as really weird that he went to the inauguration to support this after you know, being an American citizen and thinking that he was kind of a really good coach and he was, you know, really liberal or whatever he was, that he would support this. But really, you know, he's had a lot of weird stuff happen in his job in the past, and he, you know, maybe he's looking for a good job and he doesn't want to take anybody off. So,
right. So these players return back to Iran, where I've read that their passports were either taken or haven't been given back to them. It's one or the other. And I think that, you know, a lot of people in this country probably hear about that. And, you know, I heard jokes about, like, Rocky IV with Ivan Drago about how, you know, they're going to, you know, directly disobeying a government doesn't generally go over well, especially an authoritarian government. But I'm guessing that's probably a little bit exaggerated. So I'm wondering, or what you're thinking some of the ramifications might be.
I've only really heard the passport thing kind of through the grapevine. And I really didn't, I haven't heard much to back that up. It doesn't seem that crazy, but a lot of these guys, you know, like I said, like Mahdavi Akia, he plays for a German team, so if he didn't go with his passport, he couldn't go back to Germany, but I think he already is back in Germany. So I think a lot of these guys, I think they're still allowed to play for their club teams outside of Iran.
So would you say it's sort of overblown here, because it's kind of like, look, he's done another, you know, I mean, this is a president that does deny the Holocaust happened and isn't exactly soft-spoken when it comes to certain issues. So do you think that this is maybe like another example of Western media, you know, kind of trying to portray him in a negative light and going out of the way to do that? Or do you think that there's, you know, it's the complete opposite, or do you think it's somewhere in the middle?
Well, I think he does a good enough job himself of portraying himself negatively in all media, so I don't think anybody needs to try too hard.
Now, one thing, I didn't really have all the facts about sport in Iran, and I still don't, but I was really surprised to hear about how popular football, soccer, actually is over there.
I think soccer is definitely number one, for sure. I mean, people joke about how, like, Iran has a population of 70 million people, and the Iranian national team has 70 million fans.
Nice.
That's kind of the running joke.
Do you think that this action or this situation will have, like, significant effect on the Iranian people, or do you think it's pretty much blown over at this point? I mean, this happened in mid to late June, I believe.
Right. I think the timing of it was kind of convenient with the whole blowing over aspect, not just because the guys who were forced to retire were mostly over 30, but because the South Korea game was their last chance to qualify for the 2010 World Cup, and they
right.
didn't make it.
Right.
So they're trying to go for the 2011 Asia Cup. And, I mean, they're still playing friendlies and stuff now, but no one's really making a stink about it because, you know, this kind of, you know, garbage has happened before where government has poked its nose in sports politics.
You know, is it not that big of a deal because it's just like these over 30 guys who kind of over the hill, and maybe he didn't appreciate them wearing the armbands, but, you know, we talked, I guess, a little bit about him getting involved in sports before and stuff like that. So I'm just wondering, is this pretty much par for the course for him? Is this kind of the way things operate in Iran?
I think sometimes, and I think that also makes the Iranian people like kind of apathetic about politics in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the support in this election, like the voter turnout, was really, really high. But there were parliamentary elections a year or two ago, and the voter turnout was really, really low because mm-hmm. a lot of popular MPs had been sacked. So right now, the way the election is blown over, people are just going to want to maintain the status quo. There's still a lot of other stuff that's going on after the election. A lot of people have been killed, actually. You know, there are a lot of people who have been arrested, and they're doing like really bad trials right now where 100 people are being tried at the same time and things like that. So there's a good chance that this isn't going to blow over
mm-hmm.
just because they're kind of making a mockery of international human rights. As it is now, it seems like this soccer situation might have just been a good show of solidarity from these prominent public figures.
Would you say that this is kind of like a completely overblown thing, that it's like people are kind of like focusing on this, like myself included, of like, look what they did to these soccer players, while it's like, look what they did to the people being beaten on the street?
No, I mean, like, no, I think it's definitely important because it's like they couldn't beat these guys up. This is like kind of the equivalent of beating up a celebrity, you know? This is, they took away their communicating power. These guys did this really small gesture of putting these wristbands on, and they basically, by forcing them to retire, they made sure these guys couldn't protest again. So, you know, they're keeping them out of the spotlight. They're making sure that they can't help any sort of protest cause. And it's just kind of interesting to compare to, like, other athletes in the world. My best example would be, like, NBA athletes. You know, none of them are politically active at all and really haven't been, except, you know, maybe, say, the 2008 presidential election. But, you know, there's that famous Michael Jordan quote, you know, where he said, like, Republicans wear sneakers, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just interesting to see these people get involved like that. And I think I would, you know, wager on the fact that the Iranian government was scared that these guys could help the opposition just by having a public presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely not the kind of action that I would see from, like, Cristiano Ronaldo or somebody like that. But it's it's definitely comforting to know that, you know, there's more to soccer players than gelled hair and giant earrings.
And short shorts in Ronaldo's case.
Yeah, that's it. Well, Amin, thanks so much for doing this. If our listeners want to read more about the situation, do you have any, you know, specific sites or places to go?
BBC has been pretty good about keeping data updates,
mm-hmm.
Up to date. Excuse me. And other than that, if anybody out there is on Twitter, if you know how to use Twitter, follow the hashtag search Iran election, and you can find out whatever you need.
Great. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Amin, and best of luck to you retiring at the age of 24.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
The Richmond Kickers claimed the 2009 USL Second Division Championship Saturday night with a dramatic come-from-behind 3-1 win over the Charlotte Eagles. The Kickers overcame a poor first half with a strong second that included goals from Edson Elcock, John DiRamondo, and David Bulow. Kickers coach Lee Calishaw was elated by the difference.
We played very poorly in the first half and a lot better in the second half. Charlotte came out swarming in the first half. They were, you know, full of energy. They've been playing great. They've had a fantastic lineup they put together the last 6-7 games, and they were causing all kinds of trouble. I don't think it was really working tactically, so we decided to go for it, make two subs. Those players, you know, they made a difference. The lineup made a little bit of a difference, but we just played a lot better. We played relaxed, told the guys to go out and play, you know, and just work a little bit hard and believe, and they did it.
Calishaw's squad were forced to play catch-up for most of the first half after Eagles midfielder Diego Martin struck first in the 14th minute. Richmond goalkeeper Ronnie Pascal wasn't too thrilled about that turn of events.
All right, we're here with goalkeeper Ronnie Pascal, who just got done signing a cell phone. Is that a first for you?
No, absolutely not. I think I've signed everything, foreheads, cheeks, arms, whatever you can think of.
Now, on that first goal, you looked a little angry after it went in. What's going through your head, or what do you think happened there?
Yeah, you know, I think there were a couple defensive breakdowns. The guy was running at us with no pressure. We probably could have dropped a little bit quicker, and no one really ran with the guy through the midfield who scored the goal. They took it well. You know, it was a good chance that they created. We knew that's what they were going to try to do, and I think the most frustrating thing is we had talked about that's what they're going to do and what we need to do to defend against it. But, you know, it happens. Fortunately, it was early in the game, so we had plenty of time to come back and to regroup, and we did that.
The Kickers finished the first half down 1-0, but they never really felt like they were out of it, at least not according to veteran midfielder Mike Burke.
I think we always felt they were going to get our chances. If we didn't let them score again, I think we were pretty confident that we were going to come out and at least score a goal. And if we scored the next goal, we felt pretty confident that we could win the game. I don't know if anyone thought it was going to be 3-1, but it's just such a good team. You know, I think it's deserved because not all the time does the best team win, and we were the best team, I think.
Calishaw felt the sluggish team needed an injection of energy and elected to make two changes at the half. On came David Bulow and John DiRamondo, and both players had an immediate impact. In the 63rd minute, Bulow's cross found Kickers forward Edson Elcock open at the back post, and the Trinidad and Tobago native leveled the score at 1-1. As star goal scorer Matthew Delicate summed it up, that was all she wrote.
Yeah, I think we knew we create some good chances, and we felt like if we got the goal that we'd get some momentum, and that's exactly what happened. And, we turned a 1-0 loss into a 3-1 win, which was great.
The Kickers got the go-ahead goal in the 83rd minute when a free kick by midfielder John DiRamondo glanced off of a Charlotte defender and careened into the far corner of the goal.
Well, I was just trying to play it to the far post. You know, I knew I needed to get it over the first guy, and those are hard for the keeper because they don't know if you're going to come out or not. So I figured if it didn't go in, somebody was going to get a head on it or flick it.
And I feel like 5 years from now, that was a totally intentional goal.
Oh, yeah. Probably by tomorrow.
The match was put out of reach in the 86th minute when Eagles goalkeeper Jonathan Sayas dragged down an attacking Bulow and gave the substitute a penalty kick that he easily converted.
Did you create that penalty? It looked like you did. Was
yeah,
that
yeah,
okay.
yeah, yeah.
So you created the penalty. How'd that feel when you went down? Did you know right away it was a penalty, or were you hoping for it?
I was a bit hoping. I knew that the keeper got me. It was just a matter of if the ref saw it. I think it was a penalty, and it was. Lucky I got there first.
There you go. And the referee agreed. How'd it feel to slot that one home?
Fantastic. I like taking penalties, so I'm confident in them.
The Kickers earned their third USL Championship title and second in 4 seasons, while Bulow took home the Most Valuable Player honors.
You came on at halftime. Any ideas why you went on the first half?
We have a good group of players here.
Yeah.
And it's hard to only pick 11 of them. So, being on the bench, you just have to be ready and take your chance once you get on.
Yeah, you definitely took your chances there. Big time, you had the assist on that first goal and then slotting home the penalty. How'd it feel to get those goals in those plays?
It's great. I haven't scored in a few games, so it's nice to get on the scoreboard. Deli said I was going to get one there. So a couple minutes that I got, so I'm delighted to.
And what do you think the big difference was between the first half and the second half?
I'm not sure. We knew that we had to keep working. Mm-hmm. Charlotte's a fantastic team. I think that's 4 finals they've been to in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. They're a quality side, so you have to keep working and keep battling. And we knew that from the start. And,
well, congratulations again. How you gonna be celebrating tonight?
A little bit.
You guys are all pretty cagey with that answer. Every single one of you. But congratulations and thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
A noisy crowd of nearly 3,000 was on hand to see Richmond hoist the championship trophy, a fact which Pascal was quick to point out.
The fans were phenomenal. You know, they kind of carried us through it in the second half when we needed them, and fortunately we were able to finish our chances tonight and come away 3-1. This is by far, I think, the best environment in the USL, too. Our fans are unbelievable. You know, the support's there. They're vocal. They're loud. They have the instruments. By far, it's the best place to play in the USL, too.
The victory was equally sweet for Delicate, A native of Kent, England, the talismanic striker spent 4 years playing in Richmond for Virginia Commonwealth University before signing with the Kickers in 2004.
Came over in 2000 and played 4 years at VCU, and I consider Richmond my home now.
Yeah. So how does it feel to, you know, be out here playing for Richmond with the Richmond fans?
Oh, it's great. I mean, to host a championship game is fantastic, and to win it for your home fans is great.
For Burke, a Kicker stalwart, it was yet another piece of silverware to add to an already crowded collection.
How many titles is this for you now with the Kickers?
It's 2 titles. It's my 5th championship. 2 titles. So, you know, it's pretty good. 5 championships in 10 years with the club. That's pretty darn good. I'll take it.
The Kickers started the season off in a less than fashionable style, managing only 7 points out of a possible 18 in their first 6 matches. Nevertheless, they ended the campaign in convincing form and brought another championship home to the capital city.
You're listening to the Total Football Soccer Show with Daryl
and Taylor on Richmond Independent Radio 97.3, radio for the rest of us.
Every week, Taylor and myself will be doing a top five. This week, it's our top five favourite players of all time. That's not necessarily the best players, just our favourite players. So Taylor, we'll start with your number five.
All right, well, you're probably going to catch a bit of a theme here, but I'll go ahead and start with a legend. My number five is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Of course.
The Norwegian-born striker, better known to some as the baby-faced assassin, scored the game-winner in Manchester United's 1999 come-from-behind victory in the Champions League final. And that goal may be my favorite goal ever scored, so for that, he definitely makes the top five.
So my number five is Italian defensive legend Paolo Maldini.
He's so pretty.
He is a very pretty man, but that's not why he's on my list. He's on my list for longevity and for loyalty. He's just retired at the grand old age of 40, which is an incredible achievement for an outfield player these days. And his entire 25-year career, that's a quarter of a century, was spent at one club, AC Milan. So hats off to Paolo Maldini.
Yeah, especially in this day and age, 25 years is definitely the accomplishment. But my number four is another Manchester United player. It's Eric Cantona. I like my players a tad bit eccentric, and they don't come a whole lot nuttier than Cantona. He was a world-class goal scorer, but he made headlines when he attacked a Crystal Palace fan in a style that would have done Jackie Chan proud. Later, when discussing the media coverage of the incident, he stated, "When seagulls follow the trawler, it is because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. Thank you very much." Elegant words from a crazy man.
My number four is also a former Manchester United player, but he's on my list because he played for Wolves, which is my team, and for England. It's the Governor.
The Governor.
Paul Ince, who spent his later years at Wolves and did us proud. But he's also, in some ways, the Barack Obama of English football, because he was the first black man to captain the English national team.
That's an incredibly bold analogy from my co-host over there. But anyway... my number three is Brian McBride, basically because he's the American dream when it comes to football. We talked to him about a few weeks ago, but he was pretty much one of the first Americans to really, really make it big over in Europe. He went to the Premier League, and he actually became the captain of Fulham. He was widely credited with helping Fulham avoid relegation and keeping them alive, and so much so that he's still a beloved figure there, even though he retired a few years ago. Plus, there's the fact that his skull is pretty much metal at this point, thanks to multiple head injuries. So you got to respect the guy who's more machine than he is man.
My number three is the man who some people would call the greatest player of all time.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about Pelé. We're talking Diego Maradona.
Sorry about that. What? Go ahead. What does that mean?
I think Tyler's referring there to Maradona's multiple... personal problems, which that's part of what, for me, that's what makes him such an interesting footballer. The man's life was basically a soap opera. He's been fat, he's been thin, he's been a drug addict, he's been not a drug addict, he's been a talk show host, and he's right now the manager of the Argentinian national team, and he's also scored arguably the greatest goal of all time versus England.
My number two, going back to the Manchester theme, would be Roy Keane. He was the one player on the field, I feel like, no matter who you were playing, they were afraid to go against him. You know, if you can...
Is that because he's pure evil?
Some might argue that. However, one of my favorite stories about Roy Keane, in keeping with the theme of him not being the nicest person, was on the day of David Beckham's wedding, some reporters went to a local pub called the Bleeding Wolf and found Roy Keane decked out in his tuxedo sitting at the bar drinking. And when asked why he had not gone to David Beckham, his then teammate's wedding, he responded, "It was a choice between the wedding and the wolf, and the wolf won." Classy, classy man.
Well, speaking of pubs, my number two is Paul McGrath. He played for Manchester United until his knees gave out. Uh-huh. Then he moved on to Aston Villa, where he continued playing with basically no knees.
Yeah.
He didn't train. Mm-hmm. And when he performed every weekend, just using his positional sense and his intelligence uh-huh. to be in the right place at the right time. If you can play with no knees and an alcohol problem, you're a good player.
Well, thanks for that lead-in, because my number one, no surprises, is George Best. A career, some would say, cut short by, you know, some problems with the drink, but it was also his performances on the field. At the time, you know, you look at the pitch today and it's this immaculately green thing. And when George Best played, it was mud. It was sand. It was grit. It wasn't nice. And yet he still had flair with the ball. He still could move and do these moves that you wouldn't expect of a player at that time. He really changed the game a lot from at least the way I see it.
My number one isn't as famous as George Best, mm-hmm. and he didn't have the fast cars, loose women, and lots of drink lifestyle that uh-huh. George Best had.
Yeah.
But where I'm from in the West Midlands, the man is an absolute legend. His name is Steve Bull, mm-hmm. the Tipton Terrier.
Nice.
And he basically rescued my club, Wolves, from the lowest division, the fourth division of English football, by scoring just an unbelievable amount of goals and stopped us going out of business in the late 80s.
So there's our top five favorite players. If you have a list of your top five favorite players, then please feel free to send it to us at soccer@wrir.org. And with that, we bring an end to this week's show. Thanks for tuning in. And for those of you looking for a life lesson, I'm just going to remind you, when the seagulls follow the trawler, it's because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. Thank you very much.